This podcast is part of the Gunner Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not reflect those of other podcasts or affiliates of this show or Gunner Geek. Check out other geeky podcasts at gunnergeek.com. Get ready because geekiness starts in 3, 2, 1...
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Whitten.
I prefer to jazzercise my demons, but yeah.
And with me are Melissa Mazza.
What are scissor grenades? I want one.
And Keir Hansen.
Gallifrey Public Radio. Now we have maths.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 74 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we are regularly exposed to the fantastic, the alien, and the impossible. But through it all, we have the benevolent guidance and centuries-old wisdom of the Doctor to educate and enlighten us. So I am here tonight. This is Melissa, joined as always with Jay. How are you tonight, Jay?
I'm doing fantastic. How about yourself?
I am good. And Keir, how are you tonight?
Really good, Melissa. Thanks for asking.
Good. So tonight we're talking about, as we just said, the Doctor as the teacher. So this is something we've talked about before. We're going to kind of expand on that, right, guys?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we're actually expanding on an earlier discussion where we looked at the many roles and the archetypes that the Doctor has played throughout the decades. One in particular had key significance, though, being the Doctor as the teacher, the educator, the guide. We're going to talk about how, as this figure, he helps new viewers understand the program, gives more seasoned viewers a wider appreciation of the complete Hooniverse, and from a writing standpoint, establishes key relationships with his companions and others with whom he interacts.
Right.
So I think that goes into a lot of, like, there's a lot of exposition on the show because there's a lot of explaining with all these alien worlds and stuff, but with the Doctor, because he does play that archetype of the teacher, it feels fresh. It doesn't feel like he's just explaining to the audience for the sake of explaining. He does it from a teacher's point of view.
Absolutely. And there's the reliance of the supporting characters, whether it be the companion or whether it be characters introduced for a particular episode, that give the justification for that moderate amount of quick explanation or outright exposition, or even at times it's more subtle than that. You know, it may be just something where it's instances where the Doctor is jumping into it as a, you know, I've seen this before, trust me, you know, and that sort of reliance on his past experiences. So we get a lot from him as the one who has walked the miles.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, we've also got the parts where he's, you know, literally being the science teacher, you know, saying that, you know, it's like, oh, we're in this spot and here's the things that are going on. And, you know, these are the things you should look out for. And don't touch that button. Oh, you touched it. Yeah.
I told you so. But yeah, this is one of those ones where when we did have our earlier episode, we were talking about the many different roles or archetypes that the Doctor had positioned himself in certain relationships across the seasons, that we would have this one seemed to be one of the ones that we most immediately recognized as, okay, well, you know, as Ace herself used to say it, she used to refer to the Doctor as the professor, mm-hmm. you know, sort of a similar kind of title. But there was a very distinct reason as to why she referred to the Doctor that way, is because she was always questioning and always challenging for an understanding because of sheer curiosity. Now, that was her character's nature. But as Jay just said, you know, there's a lot of different aspects as to why the Doctor takes this role on. Sometimes it's, and maybe this is the first one we should take apart tonight. This is a television show that is looking to maintain. This is not a limited miniseries. This is something that knows that it has longevity and wants to continually cultivate new viewers. When you're bringing a new viewer on, especially if you're going to be introducing them into something as fantastical as the Doctor Who universe can be, you're going to have to help them out a little bit. So occasionally they're going to have some of these expositions. So what are some of the examples that you would say are prime instances of where the Doctor has laid it all out and said, okay, I'm, you know, hundreds of years old. I come from a planet called Gallifrey that is no longer to be found. I'm one of the last of the Time Lords. I can travel through time, through space, and I've seen many fantastic things, and get in the box. We've got to go.
Well, I mean, the way that you say that, though, that's almost the premise of the show itself. You know, it's the Doctor traveling and bringing people along so that, you know, so that he can experience things with a fresh set of eyes. And, you know, one of the key components of any, like, martial arts is once you reach a certain point, you have to teach someone. And that's because, you know, that's the way that the cycle is supposed to go. And that's not only to, you know, keep it going and keep a new generation into it, but also so that you can go back to the basics with all the knowledge that you have now, go back to the basics and, you know, look at them again, and you get so much more out of it. So there, you have to be able to teach someone to get more out of something that you've already, quote unquote, mastered. And I think that that's exactly what the Doctor does in most situations.
Right.
Yeah.
It may be the basic, you know, the boiled down premise of the show, but we do see, you know, every season and a half or so, there's one of these instances where that, paraphrased to some certain degree, that same smattering of lines gets thrown out there, you know, because somebody's in a panic mode, exposed to something they've never seen before, and their brains can't process it. And he comes rushing in, says, you know, here's who I am, here's what I do. You know, just follow me if you want to live, kind of, you know.
Yeah. Well, so we get a lot of this kind of thing where, you know, he's explaining everything in the episodes with the new companions. You know, we've talked about this as being a good point for jumping into the show, is, you know, when he's taking a new companion on, because he explains everything to them as he goes. So, you know, you think about with Rose, he had to break everything down for Rose. Same thing with Martha. With Amy, especially, like the Beast Below, which isn't necessarily a good episode, but, you know, that's what it is. It's like, this is what's happening, this is what's going on, and it's all about him breaking things down for the new companion.
Right. It's probably true. Are we seeing this a lot more frequently now in the newer, you know, the ARTD era here? Because of the fact that they realize that their viewership is growing exponentially, and they have to make sure they do these occasional check-ins.
And because Matt Smith is just such a fantastic monologuist, it's great to just give him a big chunk of thing to say.
Mm, yeah.
That's true. I think that it's because the nature of the show has changed. You know, it's not 30-minute serials anymore. It's not it's not the same kind of low impact episode that it was back in the day. Like, you know, Matt Smith had said it at one point that, you know, you can't go on and do it forever because the show's not the same as it was when Tom Baker did it. You can't hold that kind of tenure anymore because your body just can't handle it. So I think it works both ways. You know, it's the nature of the show itself, the way that it's done now, kind of leads itself to the rotating cast, which does in turn lend itself very nicely to, you know, an ever expanding audience.
Yeah, and I agree with Jay that it's not, it's if this is indeed what you're saying, that it's more of a classic versus new Who than an RTD versus post-RTD kind of thing, because there was certainly a lot of the Doctor teaching, as you just mentioned, the companions and stuff in the RTD era, and I'm like, I really was thinking of Martha the whole time in the episode with Mr. and Mrs. Smith, where he has to just explain everything to her in one episode. So we did see a lot of that, but I think it changed at the point when the format of the show changed from those 30-minute serials rather than later.
I think that it's actually the classic series is more along the lines of the Doctor teaching the companions, because that's all it was. You know, when the show was set up, it was meant to be educational. It was meant to be, let's travel to this historic time and have the Doctor explain everything to us, have the teachers along as well, but, you know, we'll have this entire educational experience, and let's go out into the far reaches of space so that he can teach us about science, and, you know, it was that kind of thing. And, you know, then as time went on, it was constantly the Doctor dragging people to these exotic locations and then spending the first two episodes of the serial explaining everything to them and then doing something amazing at the end.
I can see that. There's a lot of, in the classic era though, a lot of other teachers, like you mentioned, like some of his companions literally were teachers and the exposition was left to them, that I don't think we see that as much now.
Yeah, that's true.
I look to Maybe it's because of going back to the original idea of the hero's journey and that sort of literary construct, which is one of the basis for our earlier discussion on this. When we were referring to the teacher or the professorial role, we were taking it back to the literary construct of the mentor. And if we're going to take the idea of the doctor against that sort of a backdrop, like a Merlin, or in a more modern parlance, like an Obi-Wan Kenobi kind of a character that is there as the not only the source of information, the source of education, the source of training for another hero, whoever that may be. In this case, it might be one of the companions, or maybe just the individual in distress for that particular episode who is relying on the doctor's leadership so that they can, pull up by their bootstraps and gather the courage of their own to realize that they have the strength to overcome whatever the obstacle may be for that episode. I'm thinking specifically, if you go way back, you take it all the way back to Hartnell. Hartnell was not a doctor of action or of risk-taking and things mm-hmm. of that sort. He was the consummate scientist. So when he would sort of pontificate or anything of that sort, it was because he was presenting that knowledge for others to use for their own safety, their own well-being, their own survival. And he was not typically going to be the one to jump into it, a la Smith, Tennant, Eccleston, or anything of that sort. He was not a proactive kind of a figure. I think that's where I can take it back that far easily, because it's something where he as the one to help propel the quest, so to speak. Again, literary parlance here. He's doing it because he is the source of information of the one who has been there before. Obi-Wan was a warrior in his own right. Merlin, as the great source of information to Arthur, was a wizard to be feared previously and to that day. So again, a very, very similar kind of construct.
Yeah, and I think that that Davison actually fit into the role of teacher pretty well too. I mean, on the majority. That seemed to be his thing, was like, let's take Tegan and Nyssa and explain everything to them and, constantly be a source of information for Adric. And that seemed to be his general mode, was teacher.
Yeah, that was, and again, that was, even in the arrangement of it, you had an instance where for one of the first times you really had a full boat riding in the TARDIS at that point, and he's traveling with three, and it was really sort of it was class time.
Yeah.
They asked a lot of questions. They were very curious, but they were not confrontational. So it wasn't one of those things where they would get the information and they'd dismiss it and push it aside. There were times when Smith would try to educate Clara on certain things, but because of her particular character's nature, she would brush a lot of it off, either with snark or what have you. Mm-hmm. That trend definitely continued.
And I mean, I think that each doctor has taken the role on in some points where, he becomes the teacher at certain points, but there are doctors that definitely personify that a lot more than others.
Yeah.
So let's take a look at some of the actual, some of the different ways that he's become teacher. The first ones that seem kind of obvious are when he's a literal teacher in the school reunion episode, or Family of Blood and Human Nature. Yeah, in school reunion, we've got the doctor who is literally a physics teacher. He's coming in to teach these students physics that clearly don't need it, but that's his job in this whole episode. Beyond that, though, it's like he's basically just a front to figure out what's going on. So he's not even even though he is a teacher in this, it's not anything beyond that.
I think he would have been the cool teacher, though, at that school, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
It reminded me of the I think it was either Children in Need or Catherine Tate show where he was the teacher and she sang Doctor Who.
Yeah, they did
it for a comic relief out there. But you get what I'm talking. Yeah.
But that was, and that was one of those things where she kept saying, he's not a real teacher, he's Doctor Who. He's probably got one of them sonics in his pocket or something.
But, look at his face. Look at his face. Am I bothered? Am I not bothered?
But we've got, so there's the literal, carrying the literal teacher's role within the episode itself. And then there are the actual instances where the nature of the show itself serves as an educational source. Remember, a lot of these are historical episodes where you get to go back and you grab some period information that can be really kind of interesting or eye-opening for individuals who don't really have that much previous knowledge of whatever that period is. You know, you think Marco Polo, you think Pompeii, you think, we got a handful of them, the Aztecs and things of that sort, where you get all of a sudden these period pieces where there's an interesting juxtaposition of having modernized characters in these historical points that sort of bring it to life in a way that watching some documentary might not quite do. Mm-hmm. Or it brings it to an audience that in other instances might want to have nothing to do with learning about those time periods.
Yeah.
You know, zero interest. Oh, but the doctor's there. Okay, I'm in.
Well, and it serves to give that stark contrast, too, of like, instead of, this is exactly how it is, shut up and let me tell you of the way things played out exactly. And it, this gives it that contrast of, this is how things were. Let's look at how it affects people in today's culture. So it's much more engaging.
Right. So there's a literal character placement. There's the actual education of the audience, both from understanding the idea of the sci-fi show and some of the period elements to it. What are some of the other ways that the Doctor takes on the teacher's mantle?
Well, I mean, as the teacher to the companions. Yeah, I mean, this is the primary form that we get. And we've already talked about it a little bit, but I mean, there's some episodes where, you know, you see it come to life more than others. Like the one that always comes to my mind when I think of the Doctor as a teacher is The Christmas Carol, you know, where he spends the entire time trying to teach Kazran the meaning of Christmas and, you know, how not to be a complete douche. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's all like, you know, he's taking them on an adventure. Like, let's grab them, let's go, let's look at the flying fish and feed them my screwdriver and all this fun stuff. But, you know, when all is said and done, you know, he's spending the entire time teaching him a lesson. It's unorthodox, true, but that's all this episode is about.
Right. No, I absolutely understand that.
That's a great example, and one that I never really would have thought of. It's a perfect example, though.
Yeah. There are a number of them. Obviously, you're going to have the instances where I think specifically things like I even take the 11th hour to a certain degree, because that's ones where it's not only just a matter of educating. You've got the Doctor who's in his worst state, you know, his most unprepared state, or I should say undignified state, you know, post regeneration, still, you know, still cooling, so to speak. And he's got to try to explain to a child what's going on and why she should have any sort of trust in him whatsoever, especially a child who is apparently entirely on her own at that point. So in that instance, we get so much for the audience because you've got potentially a whole new batch of viewers coming in to see how the program has changed now that the old guard has handed over to the new guard as far as production team, as far as a new doctor, as far as a new companion, and so on, so on, so on. Then you've got the idea of what actually has to happen within the character interaction to try and give this little girl an explanation that not only helps her understand, but gives her enough trust and does so effectively. And it's brilliant in the way that he, and hats off to Smith on this one, the way he carries the idea of, you know, the most important thing is finding out what's so strange about that crack in your wall. You know, and it's just that sort of stilted delivery, and it just sort of it takes us from a viewing audience a second to realize that's what he's focusing on with all this stuff. He's more concerned about the cracking little girl's wall, but it's that disarming nature that tells us he's been around this block more than once. Mm-hmm. If all of this other stuff that is supposedly, you know, knocking him physically and emotionally and psychologically for a loop. But the only thing that he's fixated right now is helping this little girl with the boogeyman, you know, or the scary crack in her wall. Then that tells us quite a bit. It establishes a great premise for where the show is headed at that time. And it just makes for solid storytelling as well. Yeah. So,
and honestly, that's a technique that gets used a couple times and is effective almost every time. I mean, you know, where do you get the eggs from? Yeah, we get that even recently in Series 7. He's still doing the same thing, and we're all sitting there like, oh, I should have seen that coming.
Right.
So, yeah.
I like I wanted to make sure that one of the things that we addressed was specifically that connection with the companions, because there are a lot of instances where we'll find that he's dealing with companions with varying, I'm not going to say aptitude levels, but levels of receptiveness to what he has to provide them as far as information, as far as his sharing his breadth of knowledge. You know, we mentioned Tegan and Nissa and those things, and they were lovely sponges for that sort of thing, because just like Martha, Martha had obviously that medical doctor's curiosity, that desire to discover and understand and take apart, where she was it was that wide-eyed approach throughout. But then you'd run up against someone like Donna, where he would attempt to provide explanations. And if it was even listened to at all, it was taken with a huge lump of salt every time, because he was just this mad spaceman and she wasn't afraid to tell him.
Yeah, but I think,
I was going to ask, does that change the way he would have to, his tact in sharing that? Because you notice, we have always noticed at times where he has more or at times less cognizance of all this background knowledge that he could use. At times things just come rolling right off his tongue, and he's got every answer there, and other times he looks like he's fumbling.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, well, it's definitely, when you've got the characters like Tegan and Nissa who, are just ready to absorb any knowledge that he just sits there and talks and just runs his mouth, and he'll cover 8 different topics within 3 minutes. And, mm-hmm. It's just a constant flow of information because, hey, he's got an audience. Why not? But then when you do get someone like Donna, it's when you see him step into teacher mode, it's because it's important. He has something that he needs to get across, because he's not going to waste his time trying to teach you something else that, isn't. So I like the times when he's got someone who isn't as receptive to teaching, because that's when you know that you're going to get good stuff from him.
Okay.
And I think what you said about Matt Smith, where am I going with this? about how, I completely lost my thought. Anyway, yeah, I agree.
Well, I'm wondering, I think about things like, we mentioned the fact that Donna isn't always outwardly receptive to those sorts of to the sorts of educations that get imposed upon her, but I think she does gather them in time. She is paying attention. She just it's very begrudgingly when she has to take on the new information, because she might have to admit that she was wrong about something, and that's she's damned if that's going to happen. Right. But I'm wondering, is there a doctor-companion relationship that you think is one of the most shining examples of that nice balance between the willing student and the compassionate educator? So he's not, because I'm thinking on the total polar opposite of it. I'm getting Colin Baker, right. Where it's the Sermon on the Mount, and it's just, the words are being thrown down at you, and it's coming, with near malice as far as the way some of the information is presented. And Perry trying to come back at it, and the only times where she ever is able to get a good side to her argument in is when they're arguing over something really pedantic. So what is the flip to that gives us that really nice symbiosis?
I think we already said it, and it's just the Fifth Doctor and all of his companions. At that point, the TARDIS was like a schoolroom, and he had this willing classroom of people listening to him. Mm. Other than that, though, I would say maybe Martha. Again, it's hard to get too much out of the Martha year or whatever, but he definitely was trying to be more of a teacher, and she wanted him to be more of something else. Whereas I think with other companions, that was kind of flipped.
Okay. What would be your take on Ninth and Rose? Because that's what started standing. I mean, I'm thinking of Dalek and some of the other episodes where he is literally, for the sake of the audience, but it's really being done as directed to his companion. He's laying out some of these explanations, but doing so in a way where he's putting this information out there almost for his own benefit as well, because he's giving himself the reassurance that he can be back a part of this, well, this civilization as far as Earth civilization, but anything in sort of in terms of being able to face some normality again after all of the horrendous things that he had faced during the last Time War. So it benefits him. It definitely benefits Rose, because she, at that, especially in that first season, was so wide-eyed and ready to see, you know.
I definitely think that that's a great example. I think that it's a little bit skewed on the reasoning, just because I think that Rose was more fascinated with the Doctor. And yeah, it's one of those things, like when you first start dating someone and you find out that, you know, they're a hipster. And so you kind of start acting like a hipster because you want to, you know, be close to them. And so you're kind of trying to their stuff out, but you realize that you're not. That's kind of how it seemed to me, was that it was like just Rose was fascinated with the Doctor. So she wanted to take part in anything that he thought was interesting because he was interesting. So clearly this stuff must be interesting. But it did play out that way a lot of times, where Rose actually did become interested in something and start to take it apart and really start to learn from him.
Yeah.
So the other aspect that we've got of the teacher is when the Doctor, and you know, we say that the Doctor being the teacher to the companion is kind of the whole crux of the show, but I really feel like when the Doctor shines as the teacher is when he's not teaching anyone in the show, but when he's teaching the audience.
And, okay, how so?
Well, I mean, we've got a couple of examples of this that, you know, that first came to my mind. Again, you know, Christmas Carol. It's, you know, I mean, it's a great story to begin with. You can't really go wrong as long as you stick with it. So, you know, the Doctor doing this, the whole thing with Kazran is a great thing to, you know, show people. It's like, look, it's Christmas. Get over your stuff. You know, enjoy the fact that it's Christmas. And, you know, just kind of teaching the audience that, you know, this is what it's all about. You know, we've got the Planet of the Udes.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, the Doctor realizes the plight of the Udes, that, you know, they're basically slaves, that they're not, you know, they're not willing servants, that they've been enslaved and, you know, basically Stockholm syndromed into accepting it. Mm-hmm. You know, and that whole, you know, the whole thing that he gives there about, you know, it's like, if he had known, he'd have come and taken care of it before. And, you know, just the entire dialogue that he gives on that one. Yeah, and then obviously the big moral dilemma that we tend to think of when we think of you know, the classic series is Genesis of the Daleks. You know, mm-hmm. that moment when he's sitting there with the wires and having that argument with himself, you know, have I the right? You know, that's a great moment of self-reflection that makes people question, do I, you know, what would I do in that situation? How, you know, would I touch the wires together, you know?
We've had a number of instances. It seems to be more so as we've. You know, how many times have we dealt with the quote unquote last of their race or last of their species trope? You know, and we've had to deal with it from a number of the Doctor's personas and seen how, you know, he's gone after it. You know, Fourth Doctor happened to have that that sense of moral compass to question it long enough to let it persist. And Ninth would have, you know, gone ahead and blown him away, you know, without a question, because he was still, you know, still stinging from the scar tissue. You know, but that sort of thing is one of those instances where the lesson being conveyed is really for the audience to be educated about something that transcends the script itself. And we're starting to get into, you know, again, finger quotes, big issue stuff, mm-hmm. you know, genocide and things of that sort, because it makes for that sort of that intellectual level to these episodes that we don't often get. You know, some of the Monster of the Week stuff is always enjoyable for popcorn viewing, but, you know, and some people really love the arcs because they have the intricacy and all of the interplay from one episode to the next. But there's a huge number of viewers that love it, where every once in a while the mask slips a bit and you realize that there are some much larger issues being addressed. And the Doctor has seen these things before, and he has had to wrestle with these things before, and he has not always won those wrestling matches. So I think those are great instances to be able to see that, you know, yes, you can rely on me for a lot of information, but it's not always because I came out on top.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, and sci-fi in general has always been used for this kind of thing. You know, think back to the old, the original series Star Trek, or, you know, old sci-fi books where, you know, it's constantly taking things like this, and it's like, oh, well, let's study civil rights, but no, they're not black, they're green. And, you know, it gives you that separation to where you take your own feelings out of it and examine the source that you've been given in its entirety. And it gives you a fresh way of looking at it. And people have used sci-fi to that effect many, many times where it's like, I have something to say, but people are going to get all upset if I say it outright. So I'm going to make it take place on this planet over here in this secondary system. And, you know, then people will understand the plight without getting all butthurt about the things that have happened to them recently.
Right. Yeah, sci-fi in general.
Yeah. So I don't know. I think that it's, I mean, it's a great platform and it lends itself to it readily. So, you know, the Doctor being the character that he is just, you know, I mean, it's a combination that you just can't go wrong with.
Mm. Well, then I guess one of the things that, and I think we've got, this starts to lend itself well to some of the listener contributions that we had, and that has to do with some of the parables, I guess you could say, that we can take away from this as far as, you know, the lessons learned from an audience member, maybe not specifically from an episode in particular or even a short arc in particular, but just with regards of what we've gathered from the show, you know, our lessons from getting invested in this quirky little British program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So some of the feedback that we've gotten from Closet Brit, we've got, you know, that she's learned that everyone has value, pure and simple. Oh, and that my fear of the dark is justified.
Yeah, there's always going to be sanctuary to be found behind the couch. So that's good. And I like that one in particular. We keep coming around to the fact that through all the permutations and all of the emotional roller coasters that the Doctor has gone through with his experiences, it still keeps coming around to the fact that he seeks the redemptive value in just about everyone. There are very few instances where he comes against a race or a species or an individual who is so deplorable that he does not give them an opportunity to try and see things through or you know, deal with the or be aware of what the larger picture is going to be in the hopes that they'll change for the better. So that idea of everyone having that value is one of the underpinnings that makes the Doctor who he is, because he sees that in a lot of instances where other people will just dismiss, or I should say other characters will dismiss, someone as pure evil or something of that sort. Yeah.
Solomon. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, but we even gave Solomon a shot.
Yeah.
Granted, we were a little surprised at how quickly, you know, we shipped him off, you know,
how quickly the Doctor made town. That calculation, but yeah.
But he gave him a chance.
Well, I mean, that's one of the lessons that I've always enjoyed getting from the show, though. You know, in the, I know I keep coming back to it, but the Christmas Carol, you know, when Kazran says, oh, that's nobody. And the Doctor looks at him surprised, like, that is incredible. 900 years of traveling through space and time, and I've never met someone who wasn't important. Yeah, and it's that moment of like, wow, I guess, you know, everyone does have their part to play, and it's that uplifting moment that you feel like, you know what, I do feel important. Yeah, you know, mm-hmm. And the Ninth Doctor did the same thing in Father's Day. I can't remember the exact quote, but you know, when he was talking to the bride and groom, they're like, you know, why are they coming for us? We're nobody. And he's like, that's what makes you so incredible.
Yeah. If you take somebody who has had that long span of experiences and has had opportunities on multiple occasions to be able to double back on those experiences and see them from another perspective, it's kind of like getting to see the before and the after of all of the cause and effect, you know, wibbly wobbliness, and knowing that, you know, you take that butterfly effect. You know, if you know what the outcome is going to be, you can trace it back and say every one of these steps along the way, no matter how trivial they may have seemed within their own particular scope, was part of this grander purpose. So that's pretty redeeming to anyone that he comes into contact with that's questioning their value. So he's done that constantly throughout.
Yeah. So then we've got some feedback from Rohit, who said, you know, the thing that he's learned from the Doctor is to be fearless, or at least to try. To put yourself out there, ask questions, without worrying about all the consequences at once.
And notice that's distinctly different from shoot first and ask questions later.
Yeah.
That's just jump out there asking questions. Get the lay of the land. you know.
Yeah, and then, you know, to be fearless or at least to try. I love the way that he phrased that. You know, it's like there are moments where, you know, you can't be fearless, where there's going to be something just so overwhelmingly, you know, horrible that you can't look at it and not be afraid of it or whatever. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's to go into it with that mind frame of, you know what, I can take this on. Okay, I can't take this on, but let's try it anyway.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, how many times has he had to, you know, fly by the seat of his pants and has admitted that he's got absolutely no idea how this is going to turn out?
Oh, yeah.
But is doing so because of the fact standing still is just going to be, you know, at least at that point, standing still and letting the train run you over rather than seeing whether or not you can leap out of the way. You know?
Yeah. I mean, like Amy said in the Dinosaurs on a Spaceship, you know, when you walk into a room and you have no idea what's going on, you start pushing buttons. You know? And I mean, that's a proven survival technique is when, you know, they teach people in survival classes, when you are stranded somewhere, when you don't know, when you're stuck, do something. Even if it doesn't serve any purpose in actually getting you out of there, just the mental stimulation that, you know, doing something is going to give you hope and is going to carry you a lot further than you would have made it eventually.
I don't remember what the premise was from this kind of a study, but it was the idea of, again, it was kind of like a fight or flight kind of thing, similarly to the idea of the survival training you're mentioning. But when you think about the fact that you're in a situation of particular peril and you're looking for opportunities for escape, okay, you can either close your eyes, in which case you're never going to come to any solutions, or you can at least open your eyes and try to pursue something in some direction, and that change of perspective as you try to move forward will cause things to go by in your periphery, which may make you more aware. And the doctor takes that on in a lot of instances where it's the Geronimo, you know, you're going to have to take these chances because standing still is just admitting that you've got no place else to go. And he's never been able to come as far as he has by standing still. So
he's taking account of all the Daleks in the room, figuring out the best exits and figuring out the best strategies. Yeah. Even when you're in the Dalek Parliament, you figure out your escape plan.
And we had one more tweet feedback, right?
From the Gov.
He says that with 10, we learn that you have to make hard decisions, and sometimes no decision is the correct or easy one. I think that's with all, not just 10. You see that with a lot of the doctors.
Yeah. A number of instances where anytime he had to make a conscious separation from one of his companions, either through their own demise or their own desire to leave, there were also, obviously, we're talking about the genocide kind of decisions, or any of those ones where I know by allowing the Daleks to persist, they're going to lead to centuries more of destruction and terror. But am I in any position to be able to be the one to cut that short, or change the outcome of time as a result of that? Mm-hmm. It's the great power, great responsibility to some aspect. But again, because of the fact that he does have power, you know, in terms of his position within the ebb and flow of time and the interaction of all of these fantastic alien species, that many times if he's being brought in to mediate, or in other cases where he sort of stuck himself in there as the mediator through circumstances, he has to be the one to make a decision that is not going to satisfy everyone. And it by no means is going to always be the easy one, because if it was going to be an easy one, we wouldn't be watching the show.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And I mean, I think back to the Waters of Mars episode where the doctor has that choice. He's like, you know, it's a fixed point in time. I can't mess with this. You know, so you can either sit there and leave and watch these people die and know exactly what's going to happen to them, or you can take chances and take them with you. You know, there might be a right one looking back historically or something like that, but that there's no right decision there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very true. I try to think back to some of the more recent episodes dealing with the Silurians, when we first had to start realizing the fact that okay, well, we have this particular situation where there was a species that claimed that they had a that it argued that they had a better claim to the surface of the Earth than the ape inhabitants. You know, and that episode in particular was one of those ones where you're like, okay, I'm seeing some of these undertones of things like, you know, Native Americans and the settlers and these sort of things. You know, these are concepts that, you know, you're going to start getting into some tetchy situations, no matter where you side with, or even by not taking a side. And those are the ones, those are the episodes in particular and the instances where I really enjoyed some of the writing because of the fact that, again, as I was saying earlier, you're dealing with something that's much of a bigger scope than just this little sci-fi program. But how are they going to deal with it? How are they dealing with it in this little tiny microcosm that is making a statement about, you know, potentially larger political or social issues?
My favorite hard decision that the doctors had to make, I don't think really was supposed to be like a microcosm of bigger issues, but it was the girl who waited, where he decides to not allow the older Amy into the TARDIS. You know, that was the doctor putting his foot down when other people wanted to make different decisions, and he just, no, this is the way we do it.
Yeah, a great example.
Not a difficult decision with something like the Crimson Horror when you had to squish the space leech, I guess. Wasn't such a tough decision? No? Not as much?
No, okay. Not so much.
Just figured I'd put that out there.
It might have been for me. I don't like killing bugs or anything. So.
I was going to say, even though the doctor didn't make that decision, he was going to take it back in time and, you know, put it on his plan. No.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah, but that's about all we've got for that one. So, I mean, we're going to take a look at some of the different aspects of the doctor. Next week, we're taking a look at the doctor as, you know, a family member or friend, the times that he's filled that role. So let us know what you think about that one.
And yes, it is fair to start pulling Master references in there as family and friends, because at one time when they were wee lads, I guess that would qualify.
Yeah.
So we don't get to talk about that often. But anyway.
So let's move on to the news.
We've got some.
There's some. So the first one that we've got here is some confirmation that apparently Peter Capaldi's doctor will battle the Daleks. Let me put on my shock face.
Well, there was some sort of rumor mill going around. I don't know whether it was something that the Nicholas Briggs had originally started the rumor mill on, that there was going to be a bit of a hiatus, that we were going to take at least a full series break from the Daleks, either to cultivate some other villains, bring some other baddies to the forefront, or just to give them a kind of a break. But this is not to be, because we've found out that there are going to be, they've already started rolling some of the chassis out for filming and such.
Well, and I mean, that it makes sense. I mean, the way that this goes, and I don't know all the details of the contract or whatnot, but basically the Daleks have to appear in every season of Doctor Who, or every series of Doctor Who, or the rights to the Daleks return to Terry Nation's estate. So they have to show up at least one time every series. Now, it's been gotten around sometimes, like in, I believe it was series 6, where, you know, you had the doctor just walking up to a destroyed Dalek and talking to it. And that was the appearance of the Dalek for that series.
That's all it needed.
Yeah. And I mean, that fulfilled the contract. So the fact that we're getting a full on Dalek story, you know, it's not surprising, but they could have gotten around it. So I'm interested to see, because I mean, they brought the Daleks back for, Asylum of the Daleks. We saw them again in, you know, the Day of the Doctor. So, you know, the Daleks have been coming back, and they've been giving them a fair shake. They're not the comic relief that we've been getting for years and years and years.
Right.
Yeah.
No, because right now they have their comedy relief in the form of Strax. By the way, that's something we didn't put into the news, but apparently, I don't know if you had seen this within the last day or two. There's been a couple of blogger posts out there about saying that they had officially had enough of Strax as the comedy relief. And people have come out of the woodwork on either side of the fence on this to say, you know, either some people are jumping in saying, absolutely. It's just the point now where they've completely undermined the ferocity and the terror of the Centaurans and turned them into just, you know, quipping potato jokes and whatnot. And then the other side would jump in and say, this is the kind of thing that every once in a while, a show that has the potential for so much gravity and so much, terror in it, needs the comedic elements every once in a while to keep it grounded. So it's an interesting little dividing line here, but again, you know, especially coming off the heels of last week's, you know, Moffat hate debate and such, you know, they're blaming him for a lot of this. In fact, they were getting nasty about the entire Paternoster gang, but Strax in particular.
Yeah, it's bound to happen. I mean, no one's ever gonna, you're never going to make a decision that everyone's completely happy with. So
it's the hard choices.
Exactly. We're prophetic. So now this more falls into the realm of, I don't want to say speculation, but rumor perhaps. Quite spoilery too. We'll just put that out there right now. If you don't want to be spoiled, just jump ahead about like 2-3 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about the filming between Jenna Coleman and Peter Capaldi, that we've seen the first interaction with them in character and everything, when, you know, the doctor gets the weird hug that he can't return, whatever. So apparently the scene starts with Clara walking out of the TARDIS on her phone and becoming emotional as she just listens. She doesn't speak. She's just listening. And then the doctor comes out and they have an interaction. Well, apparently the phone call that she got was actually a voicemail from the 11th doctor. It's saying here that we're going to have a cameo return from Matt Smith in the form of a voicemail. And then people who were on the set said that, you know, that the interaction was like the doctor coming out asking, you know, was that him on the phone? You know, and then getting flustered saying, well, he is me, you know, so there seems to be some weight to this.
Right. Well, this is what I'm kind of wondering if that's exactly what this is. If this is one of those things where, it's the, how do you want to call it? It's like the little video clip left behind by someone who's suffering from a terminal illness. So, you know, if you're watching this, I've already gone and something of that sort.
Right.
But didn't he already have his farewell conversation with her?
Yes, yeah. They're dragging this out. This is why when I first heard this, it pissed me off. Like, let him die. Like,
yeah, I'm kind of feeling that same way. Where it's just, yeah, if it's handled correctly, this could be good. It could help the story along. But it's very, very easy for them to handle it incorrectly and have it rob from Capaldi's introduction. You know, here right. It's like everyone's still like emotional over the fact that Matt Smith left and whatnot, and probably not because it's going to be like 10 months down the road. But yeah, and then you've got. You know, you're like, okay, I've got my new doctor. Oh, that's right. They stole my old doctor. Dang, now I can't enjoy the rest of this episode. But if they do it right, it can help that, you know, that transition of he's still the same doctor. Because you got to think, Matt Smith was the first doctor for a lot of people, especially here in America. You know, they came in with Series 5 and Series 6. So this is their first regeneration. So it can be a calculated thing to help that audience transition to the new doctor.
Well, not to mention the companion herself. I mean, like, Clara is even more of a stand-in for the audience of New Who as this, like, new young person, like, just getting introduced to the doctor, and it's Matt Smith. So, as much as I want to say, like, give it a rest, like, I don't need to see that. Maybe I don't need to see that, but she does, and the people that she's representing do.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, like I said, it can be handled very wrong, but there's a slight margin of error where it can be very, very right. So we'll have to see what happens.
Here's hoping. Yeah.
So then some meta humor that is coming out. One of the the great jokes has always been on Community's TV show, the Inspector Spacetime spoof. Well, apparently that's gaining some weight now because they have enlisted Sylvester McCoy to join,
along with a number of other recognizable names. I mean, you've got Mayim Bialik from Big Bang Theory, or as we all know her as Blossom. Chase Masterson from Deep Space Nine, and some of the other Trek and Stargate cast members. Are all coming in to try and make a follow-up to the web series. So they decided that they wanted to create production of what they are preemptively titling The Inspector Chronicles, an untitled motion picture about a space traveler who can also travel through the time. And they're putting together a crowdfunding site to do this because they figure if they can get fan contributions to kick in, you know, a total of about $25,000 for initial production on it, they'll be able to get this together as a web series, which is far more of a bankroll than was used when they got things like The Guild and some of these other web series that we know and love so much off the ground. It doesn't take much to do one of these, but because of the fact that they've got so much willing contribution from existing talent and that great meta reference of the fact that we'll have McCoy involved in there.
Yeah.
just brings the whole thing full circle.
I wouldn't be surprised if this is only like the first announcement of people, because we've had Karen Gillan say before that she would come on, like if they ever actually did an Inspector Spacetime thing, that she would join up for it. So it's like there's there's willing participation out there. I don't think this is the last that we're going to hear about casting.
Oh, no, no, not at all. We had, when we first started joking about this a while back, I think we had said, oh, you know, Smith will probably be the first one to get involved in that sort of thing because he's got nothing better to do with his time.
Yeah.
But then we all know how much of an attention whore the McCoy can be. So.
Did you know he was recently in The Hobbit?
That film? I'm going down to New Zealand because I'm going to be on set for this film they're making. I don't know if you've heard of it. Peter Jackson's involved.
Well, talking about Matt Smith and his lack of anything to do with his free time, he actually went out and amazed people again recently. I think this was actually this actually came out today, as far as I'm aware. There's a 4-year-old child in the UK who was diagnosed with a inoperable brain tumor, and he is a big fan of Doctor Who. So Matt Smith, while in Austin, Texas, in his hotel, went and recorded a video message for this child and sent it directly to him. He's just basically saying, you know, you're doing a great job. When I get back to the UK, I'm going to come by and I'm going to say hi. I've got some stuff for you that I'm going to give you. I mean, he's probably going to give him some swag and whatnot, but yeah, you know, but just this amazing moment of him just like taking the time to record this like little minute video for this fan. Yeah, it just again, Matt Smith showing how tremendous he is with his fans and especially with the little ones.
Yeah.
And to have a fan at age 4.
Yeah.
4. That, I mean, I can't even think. I'm just probably just looking at lit up shapes in the wall at age 4. I really had no clue. Then again, the programming in the 70s was horrible. like Doctor Who. But
the parents actually responded to it and said, you know, that when it came in, he was asleep and they actually woke him up to watch it. And his face just lit up and he was so excited and, you know, just completely ruined any chance of sleep after that, apparently.
Yeah.
That's so sweet.
So that's the news.
Hats off to Mr. Smith.
Yes, definitely.
We'll make sure that we link for those things for those of you who haven't had a chance to see the video for that message, because it's out there in a couple of different locations on the interwebs, or for any of you who want to see the prequel trailer for Inspector Spacetime and those things, we'll link all that stuff in there as well.
Yes, that will be in the show notes. So just head over to GallifreyPublicRadio.com/74 and you can find all that in the show notes.
Right. Oh, and I'm going to put a request out here for anyone who might own this. We're talking about Doctor Who swag here. So we were sent, some family members sent us a box, showed up in the mail yesterday that had I can't call it a Snuggie because it wasn't a Snuggie. I guess you'd call it a Slanket or I don't know how you want to refer to these things.
That but sounds dirty.
It looked like a fleece TARDIS throw rug kind of blanket thing here, but it had snaps down the sides because you're supposed to be able to like snap it together just so and wear it like one of these snuggy things. But we've been looking at the arrangement of snaps on the sides that didn't come with any friggin' instructions. Been trying to figure out how the snapping ratio works so you can actually fit your arms through it without literally choking yourself or putting yourself in a half Nelson, which I did at one point. So if anyone owns one of these damn things or knows where the operator's instructions are online, that's Kira at GallifreyPublicRadio.com. Save us, because one of us is going to die if we get choked by this thing.
I like how that slowly evolved from like an advertisement for this great thing I got to like, please help me.
Hey, it's real warm if you just wrap it around yourself, but I know it's supposed to do more stuff. And right now I'm just sitting on the couch with it because I can't figure out the snaps.
Well, hey, it's still useful then.
It's fine. It's a blanket that rattles.
Just don't leave the couch.
I suppose.
All right, so that's all we've got for this week. You know, if you guys have any thoughts on this week's show or suggestions for next week's show, please feel free to send that to us. You know, send us email at feedback@GallifreyPublicRadio.com. Leave comments on the show notes. You can find us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, iTunes comments. Again, we're going to pimp it. Use the voicemail, 210-802-1477. We'd love to get those and put them in the show, so please feel free to use that. So, Well, this has been episode 74 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying physics, 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 physics.
Kier?
And this is Kier saying, I ain't bothered. I ain't bothered.
Do I look bothered? And this is Melissa saying sadly goodbye, because actually this is going to be my last episode for now of Gallifrey Public Radio. We just talked about this before. I just wanted to let the audience know, for a while at least, you know, we don't get paid for this. This is a commitment on everyone's part. And for me right now, life is just sort of getting in the way, and I apologize. I still definitely like want to come back on for like the, you know, special episodes or something, if you guys will have me. But you know, I love you too, and I love talking about Doctor Who, and I want everyone to continue to like tweet me about these episodes and stuff, and I'm gonna keep listening to Gallifrey Public Radio and bothering you guys about it. So for now, this is, I am saying goodnight for the next foreseeable future.
It's a see you soon.
Yes.
We'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Awesome.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows by calling 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1477 to leave us a voicemail. You can head to GallifreyPublicRadio.com to leave comments on each episode. There you can also keep up to date on all the latest news and gossip, as well as what's going on in the community. Also make sure to head over to GunnaGeek.com to find out lots of other high-quality, geek-centric shows. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2014.